Good afternoon, it's Mountain Edition. I'm Claire Woodcock.
And I'm Wyatt Orm. Amazon is looking to open a second headquarters. If it sets up shop in Colorado, it could bring thousands of jobs.
We'll roll on down the tracks with the California Zephyr, the Amtrak train that runs through the Glenwood Springs station.
Garfield County is forced to cut its library hours once again.
And we'll talk to the man who was plucked off Capitol Peak by Mountain Rescue Aspen earlier this month.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition.
Glenwood Springs City Council will decide tonight on a plan to redevelop the Confluence area downtown.
The land immediately southeast of the confluence of the Roaring Fork and Colorado Rivers has been the object of the city's attention. The plan the city might adopt tonight is to create a walkable, affordable neighborhood. It'll also redevelop a park that's already there and improve the riverfront to become home to both commercial development and public space. Glenwood Springs worked with the nonprofit Community Builders and other parties to develop this plan. If the city adopts it, the various stakeholders will start working to make it happen. The council meeting begins tonight at 6.
Earlier this month, Joe Seeds was rescued by a Black Hawk helicopter and a Mountain Rescue Aspen team. He had lost his way on Capitol Peak. Seeds was back in the valley yesterday to pick up his pack and campsite from Capitol Lake and stop by the studio to talk with Elizabeth Stewart Severy.
So Joe, you explained to me that you summited the peak with two other people who you had met camping the night before at Capitol Lake, and then you started back down. Can you kind of take us through what happened on the way down?
We got past the Knife Ridge again. We got back to K2, so we were right below K2. He started to fall behind.
One of the people that you met at the lake.
Yeah. I lost track of him. The other one, he was kind of moving fast. He was like in his early 20s. He was definitely moving. I saw him on the ridge, and then for some reason, I just lost my bearings and started to go down the front side. I think I went 300-400 feet, sat down, and I realized exactly where I was. I think panic hit me for about a second, and then somehow I just turned around. Like, I knew if I panicked, I'm going to end up dead. I knew the only way to get out of there was not to go down because it's all cliffed out. Basically, start back up. So I started to up climb. I think it took me like 2 hours to get up again because going up the direct route I came down, there was too much slick rock. I was just too afraid to take a chance. So that's why it took me so long, because I kept going from gully to gully just trying to find the most stable route.
So you got back up, you went back across the
I was about 100 feet from the actual trail on the north face of K2.
And this is when the search and rescue team arrived by Black Hawk helicopter.
He dropped in right below K2, the search and rescue. And then he walked over and hooked me into a harness and pulled me out of that last section, checked me out once we got back up to the ridge. He thought I was okay to go down, but I guess I got to look from the standpoint of the Black Hawk helicopter crew that five people died and they don't want me to be six. So that's why they kind of forced me to take the ride down.
Okay, so when you went back up to pick up your bag and you're back on that trail, what are some of the emotions going through your head as you're thinking about the last time you were up here, you were rescued by Mountain Rescue Aspen?
I just want to get up to the camp, grab my pack, and hope it's still there.
All right, will you be back to climb Capitol?
Yeah, I think I'm going to look up the search and rescue guy who also is a mountain guide.
That was Joe Seeds, a hiker from Denver who was saved by Mountain Rescue Aspen in a Black Hawk helicopter from Capitol Peak earlier this month. MRA is working to increase education about how to travel safely in the backcountry. They are planning a community forum next month.
Merchandising giant Amazon wants to open a second headquarters outside of Seattle. And that has many states scrambling to put together what they hope is a winning bid. Up to 50,000 jobs and $5 billion in infrastructure development are at stake. Benta Berkland looks at how Colorado can position itself from other states and why some aren't sold on the idea.
For a state to compete, they must have the following: a site that's close to an area with a population of 1 million or more, access to mass transit, and it must be within 45 minutes of an international airport. That's why Colorado officials think they've got a shot.
What makes this one a little bit different is the awareness of Amazon.
J.J. Ament is with the Metro Denver Economic Development Corporation and one of the people helping to spearhead the project.
This has gotten the attention of the whole nation. For that matter, North America. So we're competing internationally.
Colorado has been at the top of several lists since Amazon made its announcement, and the New York Times went so far as to pick Denver as the winning city after conducting its own analysis. The state has at least $10 million set aside as a cash incentive, and local communities have their own money as well. But Ament says Colorado's biggest incentive is a tax credit for hiring high-paid workers.
They're related directly to job growth and whether those are good-paying jobs. So it's really a reward that is credited to a company after they come and actually perform.
That's a far cry from states like Wisconsin, which recently passed $3 billion in special incentives to try to lure Taiwanese electronics company Foxconn. Even with legislative and gubernatorial support for Amazon, state lawmakers aren't able to do that. Republican Representative Paul Lundeen of Colorado Springs says many in his party would oppose any more incentives.
It's about relieving regulatory burden. That's the most attractive thing you can offer to any business person. And the benefit of that is it helps the people who are already here.
But without a big cash payout up front, Colorado will have to rely on other attributes. At 2.4%, the state has the second lowest unemployment rate in the country and a concentration of advanced industries. Michelle Hedwiger is a director at the State Office of Economic Development and International Trade. Her team is leading the overall effort. She says fewer incentives can sometimes be a good thing.
We wouldn't want them to make a short-term decision based on incentives, but be a long-term partner to be involved in the community, invest back in the state.
To stand out, she says Colorado needs to highlight the new international flights out of Denver International Airport and room for future airport expansion. The application will also look at lifestyle similarities to Amazon's other headquarters in Seattle. But some think Colorado is already too crowded. Walking through downtown Denver, the whole city can sometimes feel like a giant construction site, with new buildings and skyrises going up even higher. 28-year-old Andrea Shin grew up in Boulder and now lives in Lakewood.
It seems like more people are coming every day, which is wonderful for the economy, I suppose. But I think we've been a little sideswiped and people are coming a little faster than we can anticipate.
Shin is a chef at a Denver-area restaurant. She says she understands the drive to get Amazon, but also worries about the company's growth, including its recent purchase of Whole Foods, and what that means for other industries and workers.
The idea of headquarters, yes, there will be jobs, but there's also a high level of automation going into those things. So it's like we're creating jobs, but then we're also kind of taking away jobs.
33-year-old accountant Scott Dennis has mixed feelings. On the one hand, he says he worries about mom-and-pop shops.
Colorado has done a really good job of creating and maintaining small businesses, and I think this is one step of kind of diminishing that.
He also sees positives. He moved to Colorado from Indiana.
I mean, the people that will be living and working here for them make a lot of money, you know, so they will reinvest that money back into the community. So I think it's a good company, you know, so that definitely helps.
There are a few other factors that could work against Colorado. The state has one of the lowest per pupil spending rates in the country. Housing in Denver is also getting increasingly expensive. Colorado faces a multi-billion dollar funding shortfall to maintain roads and bridges over the next decade to keep up with ongoing transportation needs. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Claire Woodcock. In case you didn't know already, Aspen Public Radio is on Facebook. Like our page for updates on our latest events, pictures of the Aspen Public Radio team, and links to important stories. Go to Facebook and search Aspen Public Radio, or just go to facebook.com/aspenradio to like the page and start getting updates.
Yesterday, the Carbondale Chamber's annual business conference brought roughly 60 locals together to discuss issues facing the region's workforce.
Udeshi Hargett was keynote speaker.
She started her business as a professional wedding violinist in 2012. Now one of the top professionals in her industry, she shared her tips for success with local business owners.
It's definitely true that if you love what you do, if you have a passion for what you do, you could get through the hard humps.
A panel of recreationalists and creatives shared insight into the challenges local businesses face in the rural parts of the state. Affordable live and workspaces, as well as transportation costs, were at the forefront of the conversation. Representatives included Carbondale Creative District, Colorado Creative Industries, Backbone Media, Colorado Outdoor Recreation Industry, and the Department of Local Affairs.
The Colorado River District has one finalist, a local water attorney, for its general manager position. Elizabeth Stewart Severy has more.
Andy Mueller is a water attorney in Glenwood Springs and a former board member of the Colorado River District, which represents the interests of 15 Western Slope counties. The current GM, Eric Kuhn, is retiring after 36 years with the district. Rising temperatures and growing populations across the West are taxing river levels in the Colorado and the water reserves at Lake Powell. Here's Mueller.
What we at the River District have to do is figure out creative ways to, frankly, do more for more people with less water.
The River District is tasked with conservation and planning for how to use the scarce resource. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
A popular bus route between Parachute and Glenwood Springs is more popular than ever. The agency running it wants to maintain this level of service, but they need money.
The Roaring Fork Transportation Authority, or RAFTA, dramatically increased its hogback route for the Grand Avenue Bridge closure. When the bridge reopens in November, RAFTA wants to keep this level of service. Yesterday, RAFTA CEO Dan Blankenship asked Garfield County's commissioners to help fund this. Their response was lukewarm at best. They did, however, agree to keep funding the current hogback service into December.
Pitkin County officials are working on a trail that will eventually connect Carbondale to Crested Butte. They've released possible routes for Pitkin County's section, which runs to the top of the McClure Pass. Elizabeth Stewart Severy took a tour of the area, exploring both the history and the future of the corridor.
Somewhere in this vicinity was the original Ute Trail.
That's Dale Will, who works for Pitkin County's Open Space and Trails. He explains there's a long history of people traveling through the Crystal River Valley, on foot, in wagons, by rail, and now in cars. Last year, Governor John Hickenlooper named the area one of 16 priority corridors in the state for a new trail, and Open Space and Trails staff have released possible alignments for how it could wind through the Crystal Valley. Dale walks along an old rail bed that is one possible route.
There we go. We just walked by one of our wildlife cameras. We should have smiled, but
the county already manages several parcels in the Crystal Valley, including Red Wind Point and Faloha Meadows. Dale says the old rail platform that runs up much of the valley is a promising option for sections of the trail.
Laying a trail on top of a railroad grade is actually about the easiest possible thing you can do, the least expensive and the least impactive, because the grade we're walking on right now had 20-ton locomotives rolling up and down it for 50 years. It's already stable, it's compacted, it's flat.
It's tucked along the east side of the river. On the other side is Highway 133. A consultant for Pitkin County Open Space and Trails has divided the proposed trail into 20 segments, each with two choices, one alongside Highway 133 and an off-highway alternative. While converting the rail bed is relatively simple, a trail along the highway at Red Wind Point and other spots would be more complicated. Highway 133 runs along a steep band of cliffs, and there's a sheer drop from asphalt to river, Dale explains.
To squeeze a trail between a highway and a river in a narrow canyon, it's going to require some pretty fancy engineering in a lot of locations.
So we jump in the car to check out some of those spots.
So we're in the narrows of the Crystal Valley.
As the name suggests, it's a tight squeeze between cliff, road, and river. A trail along the two-way highway would need to be cantilevered out over the river like a linear bridge. This stretch is less than a mile, and it comes with an estimated $11 million price tag. By contrast,
opposite the river from us, there's not one, but there are two old grades.
An old wagon road and a rail platform, and converting one of those to a multi-user trail would be less than $500,000, a fraction of the cost. But certainly cost and engineering aren't the only concerns. We pull over just past the Narrows, above the popular Penny Hot Springs, and across the river from designated open space.
The Philoha Meadows Nature Preserve is one of the crowning achievements of the open space program to date.
The meadow extends from the riverbank, fed by mineral hot springs.
Because of the geothermal activity, we have a lot of rare plants and insects that are down along the river. We've got fireflies and we've got orchids. Further upslope, we've got elk and we've got Rocky Mountain Bighorn sheep.
And this is one area where protecting wildlife habitat has long been a concern. Many segments in the off-highway alternative pass through migration corridors and high-quality habitat for elk and bighorn sheep. A trail could have negative environmental impacts in these areas, much like homes that were developed nearby.
There are wildlife sensitivities in the valley, and that's something we've known. In fact, that's the reason we've invested millions and millions of dollars to prevent these little subdivisions from consolidating in one linear strip of housing all the way up and down the river.
Both of the Picken County properties in the Crystal River Valley have 8-month seasonal closures to protect wildlife. Dale says this approach is working and could be used to address many of the environmental impacts of the proposed trail. Still, developing this is a tricky balance.
It's going to take some creativity to figure out how to thread the needle if we're going to be able to achieve this trail.
And the county is looking for the public's help. Staff has created a GIS map of the valley showing the options for each segment. You can take a virtual tour of the alternatives, see the environmental impacts, the engineering concerns, the costs, and how each stretch might feel for someone on foot or bike or horseback.
We all want to protect wildlife. We all want to be careful with public funding. And we want to end up with a trail that's pleasant to be on.
Public feedback on how to make that happen is due by the end of October. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
Garfield County Libraries reduced their hours across all branches this month. It's the second time the system has reduced its hours since December. Claire joined producer Kristen Kay in the studio to explain the impact.
So Garfield County already had to make cuts to its libraries last year.
Yeah. Last December, Garfield County Libraries found out there would be a $1.2 million decrease in operating revenue. This is due to a decrease in property tax that's directly related to a stark decline in oil and gas production in the area. So Garfield County Libraries cut 25% of their staff, but only shaved open hours across all branches by 7%. Since then, Garfield County Libraries has found that the ratio of staffing to open hours is not sustainable.
That sounds like it must have been really hard on employees.
It was. I spoke with Amy Shipley. She's the assistant executive director to Garfield County Libraries. She told me since staff cuts last December, remaining employees have been spending more of their time shelving books and less time on community programming. That's because they're now understaffed. In the past 8 months, Shipley said across all Garco library branches, there have been 12 emergency closures due to staff shortages.
Is that when the library just has to close without any warning?
Yeah. And Shipley says the Garco libraries have seen about a 20% decrease in circulation this year over last.
So last month, the Garfield County Libraries decided to cut their hours again across all 6 branches from Carbondale to Parachute. These new hours took effect September 5th. What are some of the most notable changes?
So some of the most notable changes are that all branches are opening later in the mornings. While all Garco libraries opened at 10 a.m. pretty much across the board, they're now all opening at 11 a.m. Also, all 6 branches are now closed on Sundays. This is likely to impact people who work weekdays and can't make it to the library during that time.
Who else in the community is going to be affected by these cuts?
Shipley does say the branches are collaborating to get materials for people to other branches and library systems throughout the valley if they can't make it to their preferred branch during open hours. But besides that, Garfield County Libraries don't have a new strategic plan to get people back in the door. They haven't quite gotten that far in the process yet.
Should the community expect more cuts in the future?
Shipley told me no further employees have been laid off since the second reduction of hours were announced last month, and they don't foresee any new cuts happening in 2018.
Okay, thank you, Claire.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Wyatt Orm. To stay in the know with what's happening with Aspen Public Radio and throughout the community, like our Facebook page and other social media channels. On our Facebook page, you can interact with our station through comments on our posts and by messaging us directly. This is also the place to go for breaking news and other important updates on what's happening in the Valley and statewide. Check it out by searching Aspen Public Radio on Facebook.
Hikers and hunters will soon be able to access public lands acquired in a controversial property exchange earlier this year. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy has details.
The Bureau of Land Management is scheduled to start construction this week of a small parking area at the entrance to Schutte Ranch outside of Carbondale. While the land has been public since March, it's only been accessible on foot through the Red Hill Recreation Area. The new parking lot is along County Road 112. Schutte Ranch was part of a land exchange with billionaire Leslie Wexner. The BLM traded about 1,200 acres of difficult-to-access land near the base of Mount Sopris for 670 acres of once private property. This led to a protracted legal battle over the value of the land. The federal agency is slated to start work on a management plan for the area this winter. Until that is established, no motorized vehicles or bikes are allowed. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
A new partnership between the Aspen Music Festival and school and an AmeriCorps program has brought five new music teachers to the Valley.
This new relationship is providing funding, training, and management for the new full-time teachers who have come to the Valley this fall under the Artist's Year Fellowship Program. Margot Drakos is founder and CEO of Artist's Year, the new AmeriCorps program helping to expand arts education for adolescents. She says the Roaring Fork Valley is the first rural area in the country to work with these young educators.
These individuals who have a deep passion for their art form, if you will, and humanity, to have a chance to become stakeholders in their local communities through arts education and service.
Three of the teachers are working in Basalt schools from grades K through 12. The other two fellows are teaching with the Aspen Music Festival and Schools After Works program, which collaborates with schools from Aspen to Glenwood.
Garfield County officials are considering a proposal for 55 new gas wells in a Battlement Mesa neighborhood. Two citizen groups are fighting the development. Environment reporter Elizabeth Stewart-Severy has been following the issue and discussed the proposal with producer Kristen Kay.
Garfield County is known for energy development. What's unique about this proposal?
Well, the community where these wells are proposed, Battlement Mesa, was originally marketed as a retirement community, golf and views and a mild climate. So residents there are concerned that their neighborhood is being industrialized. There are already over 50 gas wells being developed, and they're concerned about the pace at which development is happening.
And what's the latest round of concerns?
So both Battlement Concerned Citizens and the Grand Valley Citizens Alliance say that residents in this area haven't been sufficiently prepared for what lies ahead if this project is approved. Let me give some background on the approval process. URSA Resources will need to get approval from both the county and the state for this project. At the state level, because the proposed wells are within 500 feet of homes, URSA needs to get waivers signed from all the residents. They've been working on this. They've offered the residents some money, but Matt Sura, who's the attorney for these citizen groups, says the people living nearby are not prepared for the types of impacts they'll see.
Those folks should be compensated so they can move.
So he's pushing for enough money for temporary housing. Development of a gas well means 24/7 work for a long period of time of noise and trucks and lights and smells and more. And all of that would be happening in an area that is zoned for residential use. So that's where the county comes in.
And what would need to happen at the county level?
The county needs to go through a land use change, which is why this is in front of Garfield County Planning and Zoning. And in this case, Matt Sura and the groups he represents say residents just haven't been adequately notified. The county reportedly did not notify the residents who live closest to those wells, the ones living in the trailer park. The county says that because this is a land use issue, only the property owner needs to be informed. The residents in the trailer park are all renters, so Matt Sura says this is a classic case of broken environmental justice.
Environmental justice is ensuring that those who are least able to protect themselves, either through barriers in culture, in language, socioeconomic status, are protected by the government.
Ansura says because these residents weren't fully notified of what was being proposed in the neighborhood, that Garfield County violated this obligation to protect those who need it most.
Okay, so where is this proposal in the process? What's happening?
Well, there was that planning and zoning meeting last week, but nothing was decided because URSA asked to change the conditions of approval. So it will go back in front of that commission on September 26th.
Okay, thank you, Elizabeth.
Yep.
The California Zephyr is Amtrak's train from Chicago to the Bay Area. It stops in Glenwood Springs. The Glenwood station is the second busiest in the state, next to Denver. But Amtrak's funding isn't set in stone. Earlier this month, the House of Representatives sparred over the future of trains like the Zephyr.
Giovanni Grasso and Melvina Cannon are sitting outside the train station in Glenwood Springs. They seem relaxed and a little bored. Just how long have they been waiting for the train?
Oh man, all day.
Long time.
All day, yeah. Because the train is delayed. In fact, it was delayed coming here.
They rode the California Zephyr here yesterday. The views, they say, were spectacular. The train winds through places like Gore Canyon, which you can't even drive to. The long line of silver cars finally rumbles and clangs into the station. Tom Laughlin gets out. He boarded in Reno. He's headed to Avon to visit his grandkids. He says he doesn't mind being late.
If you get bent out of shape by that, you have no business on the train.
But some members of Congress are bent out of shape about the train. Amtrak operates 15 long-distance trains. The California Zephyr is one of them, and they're late about half the time. They're expensive to run, but don't really carry many passengers in the grand scheme of things.
America's children and grandchildren, that is...
Which is a problem for Alabama Congressman Mo Brooks. Here he is on C-SPAN. It's September 6th. He's introducing an amendment to the federal budget to effectively discontinue long-distance trains like the Zephyr in the name of fiscal responsibility.
We should force Amtrak to be self-sufficient. We should force Amtrak passengers to pay their own travel costs. We must cut Amtrak from the government dole.
But are cuts to Amtrak really where the federal deficit will be made up?
I find it kind of absurd to try to address $20 trillion by cutting what is essentially $1 billion of spending on passenger trains.
Sean Jeansgale is the Vice President of Government Affairs and Policy at the National Association of Railroad Passengers, NARP for short. They advocate for train travel. Also, Amtrak serves some really rural places, Jeansgale says, places that
don't have an alternative. We see Amtrak providing a very important role to connect these communities to the wider world.
This is not to mention the historical importance the train has to places like Glenwood Springs. Lisa Langer is the vice president of marketing for the Glenwood Springs Chamber of Commerce. Without the train, there might not be a Glenwood Springs or any of its amenities.
You know, if it weren't for the train, how would people have decided to build that beautiful pool? I mean, why would they have done that? They wouldn't have, because they couldn't have gotten people there.
And local businesses still rely enormously on the train. Ken Murphy owns the Glenwood Adventure Company. It's an outfitter that takes people rafting and horseback riding. A lot of his customers come on the train.
If the California Zephyr didn't stop in Glenwood Springs, it would be a devastating blow to my business and our community. We are actually pushing for them to add more cars because there's times here during the summer months that it's full.
That said, Amtrak operates on aging infrastructure.
People are riding on rail cars that are 35 years old. Some of them even get up to 40 and 50 years old.
Sean Jeansgale of NARP says if anything, Amtrak needs more investment in order to improve their service.
The amendment is not adopted. The unfinished business...
Representative Brooks's amendment was defeated soundly. Scott Tipton, who represents most of the Western Slope, voted against it. For now, the California Zephyr will continue to arrive in Glenwood Springs each day. But the Senate still has to approve the federal budget, and there's no guarantee they won't drive the train right off its rails.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Claire Woodcock.
And I'm Wyatt Orm. To hear this show again or subscribe to our Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup. News director Carolyn Zachariasen talks with a panel of local journalists about this week's news.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.